Can I tell you a story? To be fair, it's not really my story to tell. But I can't help but feel that it's something you need to hear. I know what it's like to be different. To feel like an outsider or a foreigner. Like you don't fit in. You don't belong. But I've come to realize that it doesn't matter where you've come from or what sort of family you were born into, but rather who you're following and what you'll risk to do so. So please, let me tell you a story. Not too long ago, there was a famine in Israel, and a Hebrew named Elimelech decided to move his family across the Salt Sea to the nearby country of Moab, including his wife Naomi and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. It wasn't the easiest time for them, as not only had the food shortage forced them out of their home, but it compelled them to live in a distant nation with a foreign people who didn't exactly welcome immigrants, especially Israelites. But they endured, despite the hardships, and those of us who live nearby came to know a humble and compassionate family, one so closely knit you wouldn't think anything could tear them apart. And Naomi, she was the glue binding them all together, separated from her home and yet so patient and full of life. But all of that seemed to fade when Elimelech passed away. And we watched as this once vibrant woman was emptied of all her joy. She hardly even had time to grieve, as she was now a single parent, responsible for two sons and in need of security for the family name. As they were still on foreign soil, the only option was for her sons to marry Moabite women who could conceive heirs and carry on the family line. That's where I came in, along with a fellow Moabite woman named Orpah. We married her sons, thus becoming a part of the family. And I grew to love my mother-in-law. Because even though we were foreigners and had grown up worshiping other gods, she still loved us and accepted us like we were her own. And I fully expected to soon see joy return to this family. But as the years went on, people started to notice that Orpah and I hadn't borne any children yet. It wasn't as if we weren't trying. It just wasn't happening. And we knew we had to keep trying in order to not bring shame to the family. But we lost our chance. Because one year during the wheat harvest, suddenly both Mahlon and Chilion grew ill, and within a month of each other had passed away too. So in a matter of 10 years, all three of us were widows and childless, and we couldn't understand why. We didn't even know how to handle it. How do you deal with death when death itself won't leave you alone? I remember standing there, watching them bury Naomi's two sons, and just from the pain in her eyes, it was as if they were burying her too. She wasn't the same woman anymore, as if the spirit that had once filled her had completely deserted her, leaving her empty and dry. She hated living in Moab, in a strange country with no one but Orpah and myself for comfort. So as soon as she found out that Yahweh, the God of Israel, had restored food in their land again, she immediately rushed home to tell Orpah and I of her plans to move back. First, we didn't know how to react. Leave the safety and security of Moab and go to Israel? Of course we didn't want to. They would never accept us there. For all we knew, they would blame us for Naomi's misfortune, saying, "See, that's what happens when you invite foreigners into Yahweh's holy family." How would they react to us moving into their country? Regardless, we knew our obedience to Naomi was more important than our anxieties, so we kept our mouths closed. Spent the next few days gathering our belongings, and we're soon on the way down the road leading to Judah. We had traveled a fair distance, Orpah and I discussing what we would do once we arrived, how we would manage. But I could sense that there was something bothering Naomi. She was quiet and seemed troubled, more than usual. And just as I was about to speak to her, she suddenly turned to face Orpah and I and said, "Go back." At first, we thought maybe we'd forgotten something. But she said it again, "No, go back, both of you, to your mother's home." We just stood there shocked. What was she talking about? We couldn't just leave her. Who would look after her? Who would take care of her? Who would make sure that when she got to Bethlehem that everything would be... And then it hit me that maybe she wanted us gone. Maybe she blamed us too for everything that had happened to her. Maybe we only reminded her of her pain. Maybe she thought... But then I felt her take hold of my hand. And she had Orpah's as well. And she looked at both of us and said, "May the Lord show kindness to you, as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." It dawned on us then that she believed she was a burden on us, not the other way around. She was the one feeling guilty for asking us to forego all other possible futures for her well-being. She knew that it would be hopeless for us to find other husbands in Israel, as we were both foreign and barren widows. But even though she began crying and pressing us to go, of course we refused. How could we? She had accepted us into her home, foreigners, and loved us better than our own mothers had. With a love like that available, why would you not want to follow? But she tried to reason with us. "Why should you stay with me? I can't give you two more sons to marry. I have none. Even if I married tomorrow and gave birth in my old age, would you wait for them to grow up? No. Go home. It is more bitter for me than for you, because Yahweh's hand has gone out against me." We had heard this before, many times over the past few years, as Naomi had grown in her frustrations, growing more and more irritated, frustrated, resentful, bitter. I remember once walking outside to see her drawing water from a nearby well, but she was struggling to bring up a full bucket. She'd fumble it, drop it, spill it over and over. Was never able to bring it up full. Eventually, she'd curse the activity altogether, throw the empty jar on the ground, and storm back inside. This was who she had become. And her selfless heart didn't want us to bear that burden any longer. It was enough for Orpah. She kissed us both goodbye and headed back down the road on which we had come, and I never saw her again. I couldn't blame her. It was the sensible thing to do and what our mother-in-law wanted. But when I looked at Naomi, I just couldn't fathom leaving her. I didn't care about finding another husband, starting a new life, forgetting about the past, forgetting about her. Everything within me just wanted to be with her, to live with her, to share in her pain, and hopefully someday see joy return to her life. So I grabbed hold of her and I refused to let go. And she hugged me, stroked my hair, spoke gently to me, but still kept pressing me to leave. Go back to my people and my gods. Forget about the past. Forget about her, until finally I just screamed, "Stop it! Stop urging me to leave you or turn away from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And may Yahweh deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. I had no idea at the time where the strength for those words was coming from. Because now looking back, I was choosing that day to be an exile, separated from my people in Israel, to be an Israelite, which didn't make any sense because I was terrified of both her people and her God. But all reason aside, it worked. Because after a speech like that, she knew she didn't have a choice in the matter. So we kept going. And when we finally reached Bethlehem, the whole town exploded with excitement. Word had gotten around that Naomi was returning home, and everyone wanted to see her. But it was quickly apparent that the Naomi who everyone remembered was not the same Naomi that had returned. Many didn't even recognize her, and she didn't want to be called Naomi anymore, but rather Mara, because the Lord had brought misfortune upon her and made her life bitter. She had left full, but Yahweh had brought her back empty. Standing in the crowds that day, I couldn't help but feel that I was a symbol of that misfortune. Everyone staring at me, judging me, voices in my head kept screaming, "Get out while you still can." But every time I looked at Naomi, those voices would just go away, and I knew that this was where I needed to be. She was my home and my priority. I had devoted my life to her. We needed each other. Unfortunately, we also needed lunch. The food that we had brought with us from Moab would only last for so long, so I knew I had to work something else out. Thankfully, the barley harvest was just beginning, so I thought maybe I could enter a nearby field, gain favor with the farmer, and then be permitted to both glean and gather after the harvesters. But I knew it was a risk. Gleaners, by law, were always welcomed in the fields, as they were most often the poor who simply picked up the scraps. But that wouldn't be enough. I had to gather as well, like one of the servant girls, and collect as many leftover stalks as possible. Naomi was, of course, a little hesitant to let me go, as working in a field with men is a very vulnerable position, particularly as a foreigner. Gaining their favor would not be an easy task. But I reminded her that this was really our only hope for nourishment, so she had to concede. The following day, I found myself entering a nearby field where the farmer was not actually present. So I spoke with the foreman and, thankfully, gained his permission to both glean and gather after the harvesters. It was all sweat and toil after that. The sun burned hard that day. Sweat dripped down my face and my muscles ached after hours of constant kneeling and bending. But I had to keep going. Naomi hadn't eaten in a few days and had already grown quite weak. So apart from a short break, I worked steady throughout the morning. Thankfully, the men did the same, but I would occasionally catch them looking suspiciously in my direction, and I feared what the afternoon might bring. The servant girls had the security of ownership, but I was not a part of them. I had grown rather thirsty, too. At about midday, I was kneeling down to gather some sheaves when I heard a loud voice shout across the field, "The Lord be with you!" And before I could even determine where that voice had come from, suddenly all the men stopped working and shouted back, "The Lord bless you!" I turned in the direction that the men were facing and saw a tall male figure coming across the field towards us, who I could only assume was the farmer. Well, as he drew near, I remembered that I had not specifically been given this man's permission to work in his field. And as soon as I saw him and the foreman talking and looking my way, my heart began to race. Fearing his reaction to what I'm sure was my unwelcomed presence, I began to scramble my bundles together in an attempt to leave as quickly as possible. But then I felt a shadow cross over me. And I looked up, and there was the farmer gazing down at me. I started to babble out an apology and express my intention to leave, but he stopped me and said, "My daughter, don't go and glean in another field. Don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." I think it's fair to say I was not expecting that. Either way, you'd think that I'd have had the composure to simply bow my head and thank this generous farmer for his hospitality. But I fell flat on my face, nose in the dirt, tears forming a minor ocean in front of me, completely overwhelmed by this man's kindness. It was all I could do but ask, "Why? Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" As it turned out, he had heard what I had done for Naomi, how I had left my homeland and my people to come and live with her. And then he said to me, "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Refuge. His words confused me. Israel had seemed like anything but a refuge to me, and I was aware of this God, Yahweh. But this man was speaking as if his God was some sort of home or shelter, a place of safety. It was a concept that was completely foreign to me. But the feeling that it provided wasn't. With Naomi, I had that feeling of security. There was something about her that drew you in, made you curious, made you wonder where that feeling came from. I couldn't think much more about it. This man, whose name I found out was Boaz, invited me to join them for lunch, to share in the food that he had brought out for the workers. And let me tell you, bread has never tasted so good. I'm certain I ate more than all the harvesters put together. And there was this wine vinegar that you could dip the bread in. It filled me right up. But then I remembered Naomi, hungry and empty, and I made sure to gather up some of the leftovers to carry home for her. That afternoon, I was able to join with the servant girls, which made the work much more bearable, and I no longer felt threatened by the men. If anything, it seemed like they were helping me, which sounds absurd, I know, but I could have sworn that I saw a few of them purposefully pull stalks from their bundles and leave them on the ground in front of me to pick up. Who knows? Perhaps the sun was just getting to me. Either way, I was able to gather abundantly more that afternoon, and Boaz invited me to return the following day and continue harvesting until the season was finished. By the time evening came around, I was exhausted, but yet at the same time so excited to go home and show Naomi how much I'd been able to gather. When I walked in the door, she was ecstatic, and I hadn't even shown her the leftover bread from lunch. But of course she had to ask how I had come to be so fortunate. So I told her all about the servant girls and Boaz and the foreman and how the men had been slightly unnerving at first, but then later on, "Boaz?" she asked. I nodded. And it scared me how quickly she leapt from her chair and how her face lit up at just the affirmation of his name. And for the first time in years, I heard these words escape from my mother-in-law's mouth. "The Lord bless him," she said. And she came over to me and hugged me and started crying, and I was so confused. But then she went on to tell me that this man was actually a close relative of hers. A kinsman redeemer, she called him, whose responsibility it was to look after needy members of the family. Oh, well, no wonder Boaz had been so kind to me, allowed me to continue working. He was supposed to. It was his role. But then I thought, well, no, that can't be it. Just the way that he had greeted his workers, invited me to the table, made me feel so safe. This wasn't just a man of good standing who owned a field and had family obligations, no. He was selfless and compassionate. Reminded me of Elimelech, actually, who Naomi called a righteous man. Naomi said it would be good for me to keep working in his field. As in any other field, I had the potential to be harmed. So I stayed close with Boaz's servant girls until the barley and wheat harvests were finished. And every morning, I found myself getting nervous, waiting to see his figure coming across the field towards us. And whenever he did, he would always greet his workers in that familiar fashion, speak with the foreman a while. And then he'd always make sure to look my way and nod, reminding me that I was welcome and that I was safe in his field. As the weeks went by, Naomi and I grew more and more settled in our new home. She was grateful to be back in her own country. I was learning to adjust. But one evening, as I was washing up after the day's work, Naomi walked into the room with something clearly on her mind. "Ruth, my daughter," she started, "should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for?" I shook my head at her. We'd been over this before. We both knew I'd have no luck here trying to find a husband. It was a hopeless situation. I'd probably have more luck here finding a donkey. But, she continued, "is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours?" I nodded. "Well, tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Perhaps you should wash up. Perfume. Put on your best clothes." It was here that I began to understand what Naomi was asking me to do. And although my hands began to tremble and my face started swelling, she ignored my apparent discomfort and continued with her instructions. "When you are ready," she said, "go to the threshing floor. But don't let him know you are there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he goes to lie down, note the place where he is lying, and then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." The gravity of this situation didn't fully sink in until I'd finished cleaning up and was preparing to leave. I had agreed to do all that Naomi asked, of course. It was what she wanted. She knew we needed a kinsman redeemer, someone to take over the family field and redeem the family name. But we both knew the unlikelihood of Boaz actually accepting my request, as he'd be endangering his own estate in the process. And I cannot imagine another time where I've ever been more nervous than I was that evening, shaking with every step as I walked across the field in the light of the setting sun towards the threshing floor. Yes, this man was a kinsman redeemer, and Naomi had insinuated that it was his responsibility to ensure our well-being. But would he even care? All of Naomi's hopes were resting on me, and it worried me to think that Boaz knew my history and would only see me as another burden. When I reached the threshing floor, I made sure to keep out of sight as I inched my way closer, just in time to see Boaz finishing up his evening meal. There were others around as well, many drinking, others finishing up chores. But I kept my eyes on Boaz and watched as he rose from his table and went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Every moment that I waited there felt like an eternity. But I waited until I knew for sure that everyone else had either left or fallen asleep. And then had to use every ounce of my will to leave my hiding place and softly step over to where I knew Boaz was lying, being careful not to trip over anything or anyone along the way. He seemed so peaceful lying there. I knelt down at the foot of his bed and slowly pulled back the cover. And then, ensuring not to wake him, I eased myself down at his feet and lay there, deep into the night, waiting moment by moment for him to wake up and find me there. What would he say? What would he think? I don't know how long I had been there, but a sudden sound startled Boaz, and he sat up and realized that there was someone there lying at his feet. It was so dark he didn't recognize me, so he demanded, "Who are you?" "I am your servant, Ruth." And then I waited, expecting him to then tell me what to do, but he didn't say a word. And I started to panic, thinking he might be upset with me, angry even. And as the silence ensued, I just prayed to the God of Israel for the right words to say. And then, "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." I couldn't see his face, couldn't see his reaction, but I could feel his movements as he shifted himself closer to me. And then he lifted me from the dusty ground and whispered gently, "The Lord bless you." And his words were like a cool evening breeze against that dry night air. He continued, "My daughter, this kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character." He then, however, went on to tell me that there was another kinsman redeemer, in closer relation than he, who had priority in redeeming any fields left over by lost family members. And a knot formed in my stomach as I realized that if this other man wanted the field, then the widow would come with it. Either way, Boaz told me to remain with him that night, and then in the morning he would sort out the matter. If this other man was not willing to take the field, then as surely as Yahweh lives, Boaz was willing to do it. Before his God, Boaz was willing to take on this responsibility, even though it was not primarily his to bear. Then his willingness to sacrifice reminded me so much of Naomi. And I couldn't help but feel that all of her hopes and prayers for this event had in some divine way blessed us that night. The following morning, we woke up before anyone else, and Boaz told me to keep the happenings of that night to myself. He then filled my shawl with 6 measures of barley, saying, "Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed." I reached the house just as the sun was beginning to rise. And as I walked in the door, Naomi was all over me with questions, asking how it went. And I told her everything. And as encouraged as I felt, it worried me to think what might happen at Boaz's meeting with the town elders that morning, what might be decided. But Naomi eased my anxieties, saying that the man would not rest until the matter was settled. So we waited. Again, all morning and all afternoon, praying constantly and trying to keep busy, but I'm certain I washed the same garment 10 times over as I stood staring across the open landscape, waiting to see his figure coming across the field towards us. And finally, there he was. And by the time he reached the house, Naomi was already halfway out the door, cursing him for taking so long. And 9 days later, I became his wife. And 9 months later, I became a mother. The God of Israel had allowed me to conceive and had blessed us with a beautiful baby boy. And I remember the first time that I placed that child in the arms of my mother-in-law. And it reminded me of the Naomi that I had once grown to love so many years before. Her God had been faithful to her and had once again filled her with a joy that we had thought was no longer possible. This was the start of a new family for Naomi. And yet, at the same time, it was also a request to come back into her old family, into Yahweh's family. And I had been invited too.